Thanks for listening to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. You can contact the show at twitter.com/DW Groovecast and through Facebook at facebook.com/Drummer's Weekly Groovecast.
Good evening.
I am warning you right now, if you touch my drums, I will stab you in the neck with a knife.
Ain't it fucking.
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind you playing it, but lower it.
Well, we get straight now?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean.
Next!
Little trouble there. You're rushing.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah!
And Clifford Curry.
Well, listen, let me tell you, that might be a good place to start.
Oh, if I can recover from that.
Well, Clifford Curry, R.I.P., you know, he passed, what was it, last year?
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, I hate to hear that.
You and I were in his band for a whirlwind, what would you say, 6 months before I went to Memphis?
I believe that's right. But your last gig was the best gig ever.
Well, let's start the show off with a bang, shall we?
Okay.
This had to have been August of 20. No, what am I saying? Dude, I just had a stroke. It would have been August of 1990.
Right.
And we were playing at the Sheraton. Do you remember that? That spiral hotel up on the hill in Gatlinburg, Tennessee.
That's right.
Plug for Gatlinburg.
Yeah.
Man, this is straight out of Spinal Tap. And when we did the Clifford show, it was one of those things where they ended up bringing him on by us doing a couple of instrumentals up front with the fantastic Lonnie Carver on woodwinds, and we were doing like Spooky or something like that. I mean, right. Wasn't it? I mean, right. And that just adds to the charm of this thing. And we had just finished, and it was one of those things. And now, welcome, you know, the guy we're here to see, Mr. Clifford Curry, and we're playing like She Shot a Hole in Her Soul.
Which was his hit.
That was his big hit, man. Yeah. By the way, I researched that. That actually was a hit.
It was.
Yeah.
What was in the 60s or something? Or
1970,
or
70, I think, was what it was. And so we were playing it, and essentially what ended up happening is did we even get through that tune?
I don't think we did. All I just remember was like, oh, Lord Jesus, help me, Lonnie.
Catch me, Lonnie. It was, and they were laughing about this poor guy.
Poor guy.
And he fell over on the stage. Lonnie caught him. And do you remember, man, that it was on one of those stages where they had the curtains.
And we just kind of stopped. And the curtain slowly starts closing. And the guy's pulling the rope on the side like a Bugs Bunny cartoon.
The guy's pulling the curtains. And we kind of help pull Lonnie or pull Cliff off the stage, off to the side, and you know, and then somebody made the somber announcement, show's over, folks, you know. And
oh, God. And
you know, to put a button on how that gig ended, dude, I'll never forget it. I broke down all the drums, put them in my car, because I was driving to Memphis the next day.
Oh, the next
remember
day.
That? Yeah, the next
yeah,
day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I walked over to Lonnie, who was sitting there with Cliff, and I was just like, so how am I going to get paid on that?
Oh my God. I didn't know that part, but that's pretty good.
And that's how my tenure with the great Clifford Curry ended.
I think mine did too, man. I think it all just kind of dissolved at that moment.
Is this the proper time to say that we're doing the Vegas show?
The Vegas show.
The Vegas show. We don't have the vaguest idea of what we're doing.
I really don't have the vaguest idea. No, yeah. Wow, man. What memories. That's incredible.
Did you know that it's been rolling now for like 5 minutes?
Oh, fantastic. I have no idea we even started.
We've started.
Okay.
And it's also probably the appropriate time for me to introduce who you are.
My name is Joseph
I was going to introduce you. But that's fine.
Go ahead.
No, that's totally fine.
Yeah.
This is my version of Joe Rita sitting across the table. And for those of you long-term listeners who we all know, we've got quite a few of those on there. Joe Rita was our guest back about 50 episodes ago, the guy that John Chalden, who's not here today, but
boo.
His, yeah, I know, his bass player who's been playing with for about 35 years. Joe Moore is a guy that I've known for 30 years. We've been playing together since we were teenagers, literally. We got to know each other when we were up at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. He is back in town from Las Vegas, sitting across the table from me, and we're going to do what we call the Vegas show.
Rock and roll.
Rock and roll. That's exactly right. And that's we've played quite a bit of that.
God, man. I just can't. I don't know the amount of gigs we've played through the years. It's got to be thousands.
It's got to be.
Easy. I mean, stunning amount of, and so many different styles and so many different varieties. But I think, should we talk about, or do we, was the tape rolling when I mentioned she works hard for the money?
Oh, that's how it started.
Oh, fantastic. God, you made my day. Yeah, so we've experienced and seen so many things, not only on the bandstand, but just visually from the stage.
Do you, now, right? I think it's also worth noting.
Oh.
Do you remember who the client was that night?
Fran Tarkington's daughter, the great quarterback for Minnesota Vikings' daughter's wedding reception.
Yes.
And it was a tragic, horrible event. I mean, that was just...
I think about it every time I go in that building.
I know, really.
Every time I go in that building, I think
Ritz
about
Carlton
it.
Ritz-Carlton and Buckhead, Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah, which is now, man, they've renamed it. It's called the Whitley.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You want a really sad fact?
What's that?
I actually played the last gig that was ever played in that room when it was called the Ritz-Carlton Buckhead. I played with Rupert's.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I subbed with John. And it's just, and all that happened was like the very next week, it just turned into the Whitley. It's the exact same thing.
Is it the same? Yeah, it's interesting.
Same. Everything's the same. They just rebranded it.
Uh-huh. All right.
So now that everybody's bored out of their mind and have switched that off. No. But, yeah, that was incredible.
Yeah. That was really a tragic event. I mean, would it be tragic at any time, but especially on the celebration of someone's wedding, to have a guest in the wedding party actually collapse and die on the floor?
I'm going to bet you right now, if you want to bring that entire story full circle, that the gig you're going to do tonight, the gentleman playing saxophone, like alto saxophone on this gig, he was on that gig, Seth Kuhn.
Oh, was he? I thought he looked familiar.
Ask him. Ask him when you get there. I am virtually certain he was on that gig.
Okay. Yeah, that's nothing to laugh about, but it's something in hindsight. You know, you just have these stories that build up over your musical career where you can't really shake that stuff, you know.
More importantly, what does it say about us that the first two stories we talk about have to deal with people having medical emergencies on gigs that we play?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, it keeps the sense of humor, man. It keeps things in check, you know.
You see everything when you're on these gigs.
Yeah.
Dude, I mean, you do it as long as we've done it. You've seen pretty much everything.
That's right.
Been a part of everything.
Yeah. It's incredible, man. Just the stories. You should write a book. Have you thought about it?
There's about 100 hours of book online.
You have audio versions of your book, but yeah.
It's the new publishing, man.
It's true.
Yeah. It's the new publishing.
Yeah.
So I thought what we would do today, interspersed with these stories of insanity,
morbid
stories, is we would spend some time talking about what you've been up to, in particular in Las Vegas, because I think one of the more interesting and compelling stories is when we talk as musicians about places that people make a living and that people go to where there's industry, we always, of course, talk about Los Angeles, in New York, in Nashville, and then we talk about the other, of course, large cities that have that may not necessarily
like
be
Chicago,
like Chicago and Atlanta and Boston, you know, San Francisco, Dallas. there's definitely work and there's industry there as well. But one of the cities that has been kind of eclipsed and really doesn't get talked about anymore, but at one time was a major player, is Las Vegas.
That's right.
So I think what we ought to do is also talk about how you found Vegas, because that's a good story in itself.
Well, man, you know, so for those that don't know at this point, I do play bass. So for you drummers out there, this might be kind of odd, but that's why Phil and I have played together. But
that is kind of important.
Just yeah. So you know, for the record. So I grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee. I lived there most of my life, moved to Memphis. And of course, Phil and I go back to Knoxville, Tennessee, as he said, at the University of Tennessee, played in all kinds of things there, moved to Memphis. Phil was in Memphis. And actually, Phil was the reason I went to Memphis, which is incredible because that's where I met my wife, who I'm still married to these all these years. Lived in Memphis 7 years, and then we moved here in Atlanta in 1996, or was that right when the Olympics? It was right after the Olympics. Was that 96?
The Olympics were 96. Okay, so you got here in 97, I suppose, right?
No. Well, I got here in 96. It was like 2 weeks after the Olympics.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
So lived in Atlanta, Georgia for 20 years up until last year. And loved it, working great, you know, gigging, writing, composing, producing, doing studio stuff, doing all the stuff that you do as a working musician. And as a creative, I'm in the whole creative part of things as well. And my wife and I got to a point probably about 5 years ago where we were just like, you know, is this the movie we want for the rest of our lives? It was like I was looking at, and I love Atlanta. Atlanta's an awesome town. But it was like, okay, 20 years from now, I already see the movie. Is this what we want? And so we were like, I'm not so sure. And we, you know, made a list of positive and negatives, why we should stay, why we should go. And it was like, well, man, where should we go if we're going to move? And so immediately, cold weather's out. Not a cold weather fan. So there's half the East, not super into the super, like, humidity like Miami or something like that. And that was out. And then just started thinking about, well, like Phil said, you know, just these different cities where there is some sort of musical place, you know, what options are there? And you start narrowing it down, and then you start getting into the cost of living. And then all of a sudden your list of all these cities in the United States becomes really small really quickly. Anyway, long story short, I went to Vegas probably, I played there a few times with a blues guitarist named Chris Duarte back in 2007 and 8. And I actually hated Las Vegas when I went there the first time. I hated it. But in about 2012, my mom passed away, and it's a really long story and not to get morbid on that, but I about had a nervous breakdown through this process. And I told my wife, it's like, look, I've got to do something. I've got to take a trip. I got to regroup myself. So the first place I went to was a place called Red Rock, right outside of Las Vegas. Rented the car, went to LA, did this whole like 2 weeks sitting in the desert trying to gather my whole, you know, thing together. And
I remember that. I remember you telling me about that before you did it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a heavy moment in my life. And at any rate, I saw another side of Las Vegas that I had never seen before. And it's west of the city, about 30 minutes, called the Red Rock Casino Resort and Spa. I stayed there for 3 days. And then there's like Red Rock Canyon, real nature and stuff. Fell in love with it. And then, you know, throughout last couple of years, started going back there, you know, occasionally. So it was one of the places that I was like, you know, this is a really beautiful place. And so I took my wife there and she really loved it. And here we are now. We decided to move out there last year.
Well,
that's the long version.
But, you know, the first thing that you mentioned, or one of the first things you mentioned, is absolutely got to be a priority to discuss. And that is, you were saying there were some places out west I wanted to go, but it can't be ridiculous from the standpoint of cost of living, because I think almost everyone that knows anything about the West, when you get to some of these places, like especially San Francisco, which is a wonderful place, but my God, it's the most expensive place in the country to live now. Yeah, then you get to like Seattle is somewhat similar.
Yes, it is. And San Diego is my all-time favorite city, and that's
it's expensive.
Out of control.
Yeah. So let's talk about like the cost of living in Vegas, and let's just call it the quality of life.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's actually important you say that. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah. So how would you how would you compare, say, the Las Vegas cost of living with another city? Like, what's it close to? What could people expect?
It's actually similar to Atlanta, if people are familiar with the cost of living in Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
The only thing that I've really experienced is food is a little more expensive in general. But the cost of living is very similar to that. There you go.
Yeah. So, well, let me ask you this. As far as, like, let's say rent, housing, that kind of, taxes also?
Okay. So, well, there's no state income tax in Nevada, which is a beautiful thing. That's similar to Florida. So for example, let's say you could buy a very nice house for $250,000, like you can in Atlanta. That same house in San Diego is going to be over $1 million.
And probably closer to 2 or 2.5 in San Francisco.
Yeah. So that's kind of, if you can kind of put that image in your head. So, but the quality of life is exactly the great thing, because that was what my wife and I kept going back to, was the quality of life. And the thing that I don't like about Atlanta, which is really similar to LA, is the traffic here. I spend 2 to 6 hours in my car every time I was doing anything in town.
Mm-hmm.
And that just beats you down over time, you know? So, it was like, is this the quality of life we want? So that was one of the main reasons we moved there, because the population is, you know, is 2 million people around Vegas. There's what, 7 something here in Atlanta?
It's about 6.
Six. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you don't have quite the congestion and the traffic, and the cost of living is about the same. So if you're going to take a dive, and if you're going to move as a musician, you know, it's easier to make something like that work than to move to a place like San Francisco and trying to make that work out of the gate, you know, without growing up there and knowing people and,
or moving for a gig, like you've already got a gig.
Exactly. Which I didn't have anything, by the way. I should point out, there was zero, I had nothing. My wife and I had nothing. We were just totally going on a blind faith, and just like life change. It was total life change.
Well, that's I remember distinctly when you called me, man, and I'm like, Joe Moore's got some big old brass ones.
Well, it could have gone really bad, but somehow it's kind of worked out, you know? But yeah, it was pretty crazy, man. But it was just one of those things. Well, you know what? If it doesn't work out, I guess we always could come back to Atlanta.
Yeah.
We would just be out a lot of money from the moving and stuff. But it was a risk worth taking. What do they, you know, what's the word? Without reward, there's no reward without
right.
Blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So.
No risk, no reward.
Right. So you got out there, and I think it's also worth mentioning that when you guys committed, you committed even from the standpoint that you didn't go out there and look for a house. You guys actually bought property and built
a
house.
It was the craziest thing, man. We fell in love with this one particular area in Henderson, which is actually south towards LA, south of Vegas. And we really liked this area. We got a piece of property. We worked with the builder. And so we're living in Atlanta, but we're building a house there.
Mm-hmm.
And we could only make it work if we sold our house here. So we sold our house here in Atlanta, used that money to help do the deal. And then we had to put stuff in storage here. We were living in an apartment for the first time since I was 18 years old, and just shuffling around town. And we have 2 dogs and a few cats. And it was just chaos. You know, trying to, and we were like, my God, what have we got ourselves into, you know?
You're trying to work at the same time.
And trying to work and have, and of course, I have a recording studio in my house, and I had one here, but I had to put half that stuff in storage. So for about 8 months, 9 months, I wasn't able to do anything creatively that I'm used to doing. So,
yeah.
Of course, I had my bases and whatnot and working. It was a really crazy time. Thank God things have kind of calmed down a little bit.
Oh, I remember. Yeah. I remember that time. And I mean, it was kind of one of those things like where you had a small table and you had about like 10 glasses of water on this small table. You had to pick one up to put one down.
Eggs. Good analogy.
And try not to spill any of it.
Right.
It was incredible, man. I remember that move. It's insane, dude.
I wouldn't recommend it to anybody.
Well, especially if you don't have a gig, that is scary, man. You moved out there, and I mean, it was literally one of those things where you started from ground zero, like you were 18 years old.
Exactly, and I'm not 18 years old, and that's terrifying. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, thankfully, we had done a lot here in town that we had saved a good bit of money, so we definitely had a cushion to fall against. But it's encouragement to those that live somewhere that are listening to this podcast right now that are wanting to move or to get out of their situation. I would just encourage you to do it, because the worst thing you can do is not do something and then look back later on in your life and go, God, I wonder what if, you know, the if question. And you really don't want to go down like that. In my opinion, you don't want to have those regrets of just not knowing. I mean, you could move somewhere and it doesn't work out, but at least you took a chance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was actually the same thing when I moved to Memphis, and same reason I moved here. It all kind of worked out, and I have you to thank for that almost, because you really kind of helped hook me up in Memphis, and you helped hook me up here in terms of, you know, meeting people and getting connected to the scene. So I'm always thankful to Phil Smith here. Oh, so,
dude, it's my pleasure, man. Absolutely. Yeah, there's nobody more deserving also.
Oh, man.
I mean, there are not many people that I know that have the type of work ethic that you have, from a standpoint of being able to decide you're going to do something, just put your nose to the grindstone and do it. Because another thing that I think it's absolutely worth mentioning, and it's going to kind of lead us into a path that we talked about prior to this, is that you were one of the first people that I knew that 25 years ago, you're like, I'm going to do my own album. And this is back in the day where, you know, you just didn't throw a couple of microphones up in your room and just start recording. It was significantly more difficult back then.
ADATs and Pro Tools had just come out. This was 1996.
Right.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it's kind of like, man, you're doing records. And then I remember you saying to me, you're like, man, this is my degree.
Ah, I forgot about that. That's right. No, it is, dude.
And that is. It absolutely is.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've said this podcast is my doctorate, is basically what it is.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
It's the new way of publishing, man.
Absolutely.
So I remember you doing that and just having the ability to have the work ethic to sit down and say, look, this is kind of this new field that I'm going to, you know, I'm going to plow it and sow it and then reap the rewards. It is difficult, man. It is so difficult to do that. It's so hard, dude.
You have to. And I guess this is kind of maybe the overall theme of my life, or anybody. Well, if you really want to do music as a career, you really, really have to love it. And you really have the passion to want to do it. Because if you don't have that, man, you're going to face many challenges. And you have to have something deep down in your soul to where it just pushes you forward. So I always kind of had this driving thing in me, and I can't explain it, but it's just, I'm a mad person. I have no life. I'm crazy. That about me, I do know, you know.
Well, there was a period of time when we were both over in Memphis where we were working these different, playing in these different bands, and we were like playing in casinos and doing other stuff like that. I distinctly remember that you didn't have a TV.
That's right.
And you were like, there's a reason, there's a method to this madness.
You know what? That's amazing that you said that. I totally forgot that. I had a TV and at one point, but when all this started coming to fruition about, man, I just have this desire to create and make my own music. I remember at some point in that, I was like, I can't do this with these distractions. And I remember one day, I took the TV and I went out. I lived in an apartment complex and I actually threw it in a garbage dumpster. And I totally cleaned my total apartment of any distractions. And I was just like a mad scientist, just trying to figure out who I was or where I'm going, or, you know, what life was about. You know, because that's the great thing about music, is it's a discovery about yourself, you know, regardless of the instrument.
Have you ever thought about that as a musician? And I'm not talking about playing gigs, but I'm talking about the other 90% of your life. Being a professional musician is a lonely, solitary type thing.
You're so right.
Because when we're not on the gig with people, when we're not on the road with people, everything else about being a musician is a sole proprietorship, whether you're writing music, whether you're studying music, working on charts, whatever, or practicing, you are by yourself.
Right.
And if you don't have that sort of personality,
right,
I think that drives a lot of people away from it.
It does. And you brought up a great point, because I've had several people, and I'm sure many people listening to this podcast have experienced the same thing. Especially if you're a little older, you know, you might have, be on a gig and someone comes to you and go, wow, man, you're just up there playing. That sure looks like fun. What else do you do? What else do you do? And it's like, well, I'll tell you, sir, I'll tell you, when I was 18 years old and you were out there, you know, drinking beer and running around with all the women, I was mm-hmm. in a practice room by myself, you know, sweating whatever, how many hours a day in total solitude confinement while you were out with your buddies, you know? So there's a sacrifice, like, you know, that you have to have that kind of personality. Not that you can't be a hermit, you still got to have fun and have some sort of quality of life.
Yeah, because that feeds into what you do as well. That's part of your basis for what you create and play is living life on top of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And if you're doing a tour, you know, or playing on the road, I've done several tours over the years, and you know, you're on stage for an hour and a half, and then you have 22 and a half hours the rest of the day, you know, that you have to be social and interactive, and you have to have some sort of life with other people. And so, you know,
with that in mind, regarding that whole thing of the social and interactivity, that in itself, if you don't have some sort of social skills and personal, I guess you might just say affability with other people like that, that in itself is a deterrent for a lot of people. So it's a weird line you kind of have to walk. You know what I mean? As a professional musician, from the standpoint of like, yeah, you know, you're intrinsically a loner.
Totally.
That's part of it.
I'm but a loner, yeah, for sure.
But you can't be a social retard.
Right.
Because nobody wants to be in a bus, car, plane, airport, traveling around if you can't put two sentences together. You know?
Right.
So it's a weird sort of a combination.
Dude, that's so amazing. So this guy told me once, he was like, you want to live your life like you're in a cave, but your life's going to be on stage.
Yeah.
And it was like, whoa, he's so right. But at the same time, you don't want to be around people like in a touring situation where someone's a drama queen, or, you know, because those 22 and a half hours that you're around other musicians, or you're, you know, even on a, in any situation, it's like you don't want someone to be a drag on the party. You know what I mean? Because that just destroys everything.
It's misery.
It's misery beyond misery.
Misery, man. You can have a great time, have 10 people in a bus or in an airplane or something like that. You can have the one person.
Brings the whole ship down.
Dude, it'll make a bus seem like a VW Beetle. You know?
Right. Yeah.
It just does. So now you're in Vegas. You've been there for a year.
Yeah.
I want to talk about like the current state of not only Vegas, but the current state of what you are doing in Vegas as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I got there and I set up my studio once we got moved into our house. And thankfully, I've been able to do some remote sessions, been doing remote recording. So people have been sending me tracks. I've been recording, getting paid through PayPal, that sort of thing. Using a lot of my connections still here in Atlanta. And I was just kind of getting the lay of that kind of bought me some time, so to speak, to get kind of the lay of the land. And I started kind of, you know, checking out the Vegas scene and musicians. And along that time, somewhere in August, I'll try to make this as brief as I can. The short version is I ended up getting a gig with Cirque du Soleil, the show called Ka. But I'm an on-call artist, which is a glorified name for substitute bass player. The guy who does the show is a guy named Derek Jones. And Derek's an amazing player. He's been there from the beginning, originally from Nashville. Derek played with a band called Nickel Creek with Chris Thiele on mandolin for a while, did several tours. And it's funny because I'd actually met Derek years ago in Texas when I was on tour. I was in a band called Blue Ground Undergrass, and we opened up for Nickel Creek and Charlie Daniels' band. And Derek and I, we got there early, and Derek and I met because he had an electric upright bass, and I had one. So we kind of clicked because we were like the weird ones, you know. And so we just hit it off and hung out all day. And so that was like, you know, who knew that all these years later I would end up on this Derek's gig, basically subbing for him, you know. Anyway, he's an amazing player. So I got that gig, and so I'm basically, you know, doing that show so many times a month at this point at the MGM in Las Vegas.
So this is a good time to talk about some of the intricacies of that gig.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, to get that kind of gig, did you actually contact Cirque directly?
Yes and no. So I basically, when my wife and I decided we were going to move, it was like, all right. My wife particularly, I have to be honest, you know, I had no desire to do the Cirque du Soleil gig, not for any disrespect, because it's an incredible organization. It was just wasn't something that I thought that I would be interested in until I actually got into it and I realized, wow, this is amazing. But so I actually went on their website. There wasn't any listings for calls for bass players. But I just said, you know what? My wife particularly was saying, you got to do something. What are you going to do when we get to Vegas? What are we going to do? Or, you know, she was like more panicky than me, because I'm used to, like, you know, looking at my calendar and going, man, I have zero gigs in 2 months. What am I going to do? And the phone always somehow rings, right? Thankfully. But so I did this video and I uploaded it to the website. And then several months later, they wrote an email back and said, wow, that's cool. So you've been moved to the next round. And whatever that meant. And then I think I did something else. And then it was like, okay, that's great. You're in our system now. And when we moved to Vegas, it was like, I actually had kind of almost forgot about it, because it's so many months had gone by. And so when that August rolled around of last year, it was like all of a sudden I get this call from Montreal. And this has been like a year after I did the mm-hmm. kind of an audition video. The guy in Montreal said, hey man, there's been an opening for the show called Ka. And they're looking for a sub, and I think you fit the deal, and you might want to be interested. Are you interested in it, basically? And so I knew Derek, and Derek's, like I said, just a great guy and an incredible player. And I was like, oh my gosh, dude, this would be a heavy honor, you know? So it all worked out, and that's kind of how that all unfolded. But it wasn't something that
After they called you,
yeah,
did you have to do any kind of in-person audition, or were you just automatically then on the gig, and then did you go observe?
Well, it's funny, because before that happened, about a month before that, I had just called Derek and said, hey dude, remember me? You know, we talked. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm in town. He's like, oh man, you got to come to my show. So I actually went to Car and sat in the audience with my wife, and we just saw the show. And that was before any mm-hmm. of this happened. And so when this happened, basically, no, to answer your question. So what they did is they had my original video, and they also, I found out later, had three or four other guys in town's video as well. So I wasn't the only guy on the list. And so the MD and the whole band actually sat around and watched all of our videos, and they talked about it. And apparently they chose me for whatever reasons. But I found out later, this is kind of an interesting thing, that some guys I think were better at certain aspects of playing than I was. And I was better in some aspects, but I think the thing that kind of helped sell it a little bit was, I remember when I did the video, I didn't just do it on my iPhone. I actually went to a lot of trouble and had like a multi-camera shoot mm-hmm. where I had like a camera in front, a camera on the side, and it was edited in Final Cut. So I actually went to great lengths to make the production value as strong as I could, because that's kind of what they're all about.
Of course it is, yeah.
The whole production values. And I remember several of the guys have commented, the thing that they were struck by was the professionalism of the presentation outside of what they were hearing and seeing. But, you know, that's in the eye of the beholder, you know what I mean? But just on the surface, the overall presentation of it was like, okay, well, let's check, you know. So
Cirque has about, is it 7 or 8 resident shows in Vegas?
I believe
right
there's
now?
7, and I think from my understanding, there might only be 3 that have live bands, and this is one of them.
Gotcha. The others are tracks.
Yes, and there's one, and I don't know which one it is. There's actually an MD and a guitar player, and then there's all Ableton tracks.
Is it the Mike Jackson
show? I believe that's the one.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, exactly.
Where there's just the guitarist.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting, which now leads me in perfectly to the discussion of tracks
right
versus live musicians, because you would have to think that the introduction of tracks that's probably the main reason why Vegas doesn't have quite the cachet that it used to have.
Well, and that's what I'm learning. So the whole Vegas aspect of this is, I've met some really, really great musicians there, and you know, a lot of guys from LA move there partly because there is work and the cost of living. But I hear the same thing that a lot of guys hear. You meet some kind of jaded guys who are like, "Oh man, back in the day, I was doing 5 gigs, I was running here and there, and mm-hmm. man, Vegas isn't what it used to be. And man, I can't believe you moved here." I've heard a few of those. Like, why did you move here? You know, from like professional musicians. And so what I've narrowed it down, and that's true in any city.
I was just going to say that.
It's just times are different, dude. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just welcome to 2018, you know? I mean, it's just the way it is. So you got to figure out how to make things work. The three things I've kind of broken down the whole Vegas scene, as I can tell right now, again, I'm still kind of a newlywed there, so to speak. The DJ thing is king. If you're a DJ, you use Ableton Live, you know, rave parties, that sort of thing. Gigantic. I mean, that's just incredible.
Now, is that those type of parties, are those in casinos?
They're in clubs, like, uh-huh. yeah, specific clubs that are usually in casinos.
Gotcha.
And those guys make stupid money, and that's kind of a huge thing out there.
Really?
Oh, my God, dude. Between $50,000 and $200,000 a show.
That just shows you how out of touch I am.
It's pretty terrifying. And I have I don't want to get myself in trouble. It gets into a really delicate situation for me because being a creative person, I dig the aspect of that. And I dig Ableton and I dig, but then being a professional musician who was in a practice room for years and years and years, and I still am, you know, practicing, it kind of chaps my ass that some guy can hit a space bar and stand up there and groove to some headphones and make that kind of money. When I think about all the great musicians that you and I know that are struggling, you know, and it's like, so I see both sides of it, but I just have to accept the ship's already sailed and this is where we're at. And Vegas just happens to probably be the DJ capital of the world, honestly.
I really had no idea about that.
It's insane. And
you know what I always think of when I think of DJs that do that kind of thing, you know, and they talk about all the talent that it takes of mixing and all this other stuff. The other aspect of that is, they couldn't have their gig if it wasn't for us because they have to use our stuff.
Exactly. Well said. Exactly. And I'm not taking away from those guys who really maybe practice their craft at the whole DJ thing. I'm not taking away from any of you that are listening and that may be into that. But they're not really creating. They're just recreating stuff that you and I or any other musicians.
Yeah,
they're playing our music,
right?
You know, or things were, you know, our favorite albums that we're a part of, you know, or whatever. I mean, there's some guys like Tiesto and some others, Moby, some other guys that are original and doing their own kind of stuff, you know, from what I gather. So, or taking mixes and then kind of remixing and kind of doing a but they're more of like a mix. It's more of a mix, a live mix, like mixing on the fly, so right. to speak. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's the DJ thing, and then there's the shows like Cirque. There's Celine Dion. There's Cher. All kinds of.
Okay. Now that's where I wanted to go next, because that's another thing that when you think about, like, we'll call it like the mobbed up Vegas glory days of like the '60s. You know, that type thing. That was a huge deal, you know, to have these resident shows out there, these massive floor show and review
kind of
things.
With the Rat Pack, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and Elvis and all kinds of people. Yeah.
Now, with those shows that come through, how does someone get involved in those? Or is it one of those things when somebody like, say, Celine Dion has a show or Cher has a show? Do they just use their bands that they've been working with for years?
It's a great question, and I don't know 100% the answer, but the few shows I do know about, it's both of those.
Okay.
In a couple instances, there might be one or two musicians who are actually part of the original band, and then they hire everybody else out. A lot of the shows there in Vegas are union shows, so you have to be in the union, even though it's a right-to-work state.
Now, that's another good question.
And then there are other shows that you don't have to be in the union. So it's kind of a hodgepodge. And then there are certain shows that they use all Vegas cats. So you have those kind of shows, and then I guess the third aspect that I'm kind of understanding is basically then you have the lounge gigs, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. the 2 to 4 hour gigs we were playing cover tunes in a casino bar somewhere. And it's a gig, you know, and there's a lot of great musicians doing that, you know. So you basically have kind of those three camps of people. The thing that, you know, being a kind of creative type, going back to that, I haven't quite, and there are some killer recording studios there, but I haven't quite discovered the, if I know it exists, but I haven't discovered like a creative community, like a sense of original. Because the thing about Vegas that on the downside for me as a creative kind of person coming back from what we were kind of circling back around is it's a lot of, it's a lot of tribute bands. It's a lot of cover stuff. It's a lot of entertain me, please entertain me. And it's less value on being creative unless you're already a major star. So their whole thing is major star factor. But if, like, and the great thing about Atlanta is there are pockets here where you get guys together just to make music, just to be creative.
Right.
I haven't found that there yet. I'm sure it exists.
Gotta be somewhere.
It's gotta be. Because I know, like, the Killers are from there. Uh-huh. There's several other bands, that the big bands that have come out of Vegas. So I know there's a scene where people are writing and getting together and making music, you know, that aren't stuff you've ever heard before. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah.
But I haven't found it yet.
Okay. So with in regard to, like, these lounge gigs.
Yeah.
And let's just call it, we'll call it also, like, corporate work or corporate band, any type of groups that might play for conventions, because I know Las Vegas is a big convention town.
Yes,
also.
Sir. Yes, sir.
How do you, is there, do you know anybody that's involved in that? And I think the ultimate question now we need to get to is, how is the pay scale out there compared to other places that we're aware of?
It's very comparable to Atlanta, uh-huh. I would say, pay scale wise. The corporate band stuff actually might pay even more,
okay?
Because the Vegas might be one of the only places that can facilitate and hold the amount of people for somebody like Amazon. Like, I have a friend that works in Amazon, and we went and had a hung out at a bar one night, had a beer, and I can't tell you, there might have been 20,000 people or more at this one particular convention just based on Amazon. And it wasn't just all Amazon people. It's a long thing. But anyway, so, but there was a place there at one of the casinos, a convention, that could facilitate, obviously, with the rooms and the, mm-hmm. having a space like that. And actually, I know Derek has done several corporate band things where he's actually, you know, subbed out some things sometimes and gone and done some of the corporate work. And just from my I haven't done that yet, but from my understanding is, well, put it to you this way. There was 42 million people that went to Las Vegas last year. 42 million from all over the world. So you, and then you have all these conventions. So it's one of the last places where these big corporations like a Microsoft or an Apple or mm-hmm. Amazon can actually do something on a significant level to facilitate people. And then they hire a corporate band to come and entertain or whatever. But I, from my understanding, is some of those gigs have pay like stupid money. You know what I mean? Not on sure. the, not on the DJ level.
Right.
I don't think nothing compares to that, but it, very significant, you know.
Give us an idea.
Maybe $1,000 a man for like an hour show.
Not bad.
Right. Something along those lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty good for a corporate, in the corporate world, you know.
That's really good.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, yeah. Are there any tours, anything that get booked out of Vegas that you might be aware of?
I'm not aware of that, actually.
Yeah.
I'm not aware of that. Obviously, everybody comes through there if you're on the West Coast. There are some bands that might bypass it just because the thing, I guess the, you know, again, it's not the glory days, but it's not like what it was from what I've heard and all that. But you get people, I guess because it's so, there's so much going on there at all times that what am I trying to say? To get, if you're going there to work, you know, you're up with a lot of competition. And now it's not just music. Like, the cool thing is, and I'm not necessarily a hockey fan. I know you're deep into hockey.
Yeah, yeah.
But, dude, the Vegas Knights. The Knights are killing, mm-hmm. man. They just sweep their series against L.A. And so the Knights are like, this is their first year in franchise history, you know. And it's, like, amazing what the town is. Everywhere you go, it's Knights, insane. And then, of course, the Raiders are coming there. And
right.
And they're working on the stadium now. So you're getting into the more of the professional sports teams, and there's just so much competition. I mean, that's not really a musical competition, but you know what I mean? There's things for people to do. So how are you going to get them to come and see your show or to come and see your act? So the good news is everything's in a close proximity. So, you know, it's easy for people to get around and travel, you know, so.
It's absolutely worth mentioning that the Golden Knights are an expansion team and they are just slaughtering in the playoffs. I mean, how amazing is it that an expansion team made it to the playoffs?
Is this the first in history, right? For the first year.
I think
right?
in the NHL it is, for sure. Yeah. So that is pretty amazing. I have to say this, though, man. I have very mixed feelings about the Raiders because, you know, I've been to Oakland to see. Dude, the atmosphere at Oakland Coliseum is insane.
I know. I don't know how that's going to work out, but I know the buzz is pretty strong, man, and there's a lot of money behind them, and you see a lot of Raiders, you know, you see the merchandise filtering out. You see people wearing all the shirts and the stickers, and people are getting pretty ramped up about it.
What year do they play in
Vegas? I believe it's 2019.
Okay, so there'll be one more season in Oakland. Man, it is it's very tempting for me to go out there one more time because the atmosphere that stadium is unbelievable.
I can't imagine, man.
It's one of those things of, it's a combination of sheer joy and elation and total terror of getting stabbed. You know? It's hard. It's hard to describe it unless you've been to that stadium and kind of get a vibe.
Yeah.
It's also one of the only places that I've been that where the line getting into the stadium, you know, just going through security and whatnot.
Yeah.
There were actual fights between Raiders fans in the line to get in.
Oh man. That's kind of like New Orleans in the South, right? I mean, because the Saints fans are pretty notorious for being pretty.
I'd put Oakland's fans up there with just about anybody.
Yeah.
I think maybe the group that probably deserves it the most though is Philadelphia. Mm. Man, I was at a Flyer, I was at a Flyers game it was 1990. I was at a Flyers game. And I stood up at one time when another team scored the goal, and I had things thrown at me.
Hey, man, I've been to a lot of places. You know, I've been blessed to have gone a lot of places, and I have to say I think Philly might be the toughest town I've ever been in. I've been in Harlem.
Yeah.
Our friend Vance Thompson lived up there, and I stayed with him for 2 weeks in Harlem. That was awesome, dude. Great experience. And I went to Philly and had the most crazy – I mean, you have to be thick-skinned to be in Philly, dude.
Philly's a tough town, man.
It's a very tough town, and
You know, I like it, though.
I do, too. You have to just have to wear the hat, and it's like, you know, you don't go to New York looking at a map standing in front of the subway system. You just get on and act like you belong. And if you're in Philly, you got to just wear the hat and just be a tough dude. You know what I mean?
I agree. I kind of feel that way about most of the eastern cities.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Know, D.C., Philly. You just kind of go up the coast there, like D.C., Philly, New York, Hartford, Boston, as you go up through. I feel that kind of that way about all of them. And I like all those places.
I do too, man.
Yeah.
I really do. But not in the winter.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. But, yeah. This is a beautiful time of the year up there right now, though. So.
It is, man. It is. I'm a fan of Maine.
Oh, yeah.
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 I like that up there, too. It's another one of those places, though, where music and dreams go to die.
Oh, dude. The only time I played in Maine, it was Bangor, Maine, and it was in February, and there was about 2 feet of snow on the ground.
And see, that's inland, man. That's inland.
Dude,
so it's going to be ultra brutal.
It felt like The Shining. I was like, oh, my God, get me out of here. You know, but I know in the summer, like Maine is one of the most prettiest places ever. You know,
it's fantastic, man. It's there are aspects of Maine that I feel like I don't think it's not a secret to the listeners on the show that I have a soft spot for San Francisco because I like the climate.
Yeah,
right? See, I feel the same way about Maine from about June to September.
You need to be a snowbird, dude, or the opposite of that. Buy you a place up there and go up there.
I know that mid-coast area of Maine is stunning, bro. Stunning in July.
Oh, wow.
You wake up and it's like 58 degrees outside.
That's
you know?
That's awesome.
The high for the day will be 68. Just kind of stays in that range. It's so nice, man. How'd we get on that?
I don't know.
do you do any teaching out there?
Man, I don't. I taught for several years privately, and then about in 2004, I almost had a nervous breakdown, and I told the guy I was working, it's like, dude, I love teaching. It's the one of the greatest honors of your life to be an educator, you know, to change people's lives. And I'm not, you know, come from that place, but I was just burned out. And I told the guy, look, dude, this is my last day. Mm-hmm. If I teach tomorrow, you're going to hear about me on CNN for killing some kid with a bass string or something. Yeah. I'm broken because but I was just doing too much. It was just too much. And I never really had a break. I think I didn't have a lot of students, but I might have had a 20. And it was, you know, at that point, where in that particular year, I had a lot of really young kids. And it's really hard to teach little Johnny at 8 years old when he's doing 10 other things. And you're still on the C major scale 3 months in a row. And I had one after another. It was like...
The wrong 20 students can seem like 20,000.
That's where I was at, you know. But on the other side of that, my sister's an educator. She teaches at Truman University. She's mm-hmm. has her doctorate degree in music. My other sister just retired from teaching. She was in public education. And there's no higher calling than to be an educator. And I'm a firm believer in that because you actually can shape and mold people's lives. And in fact, I wouldn't even be in music. And I'm sure this is true for you.
Same here.
I had a guy, Chet Hedgecoth, mm-hmm. that I grew up in the band program playing saxophone. I actually, now that we're on a drum podcast, I actually played drums 4 years in the marching band mm-hmm. in high school. So, but Chet Hedgecoth was a drummer and he was the band director who unfortunately got like a Parkinson's disease called ataxia, which my dad ended up getting the same thing many years later. And passed away. But Chet Hedgecoth was very inspirational to me. And he really pushed me, man. And actually, he's probably one of the main reasons I'm in music today, honestly.
So I would be willing to bet you we could probably find 100 other musicians from that area that would say that.
Oh,
that
dude.
He was so influential, man. Including even some of our teachers.
Absolutely.
When we were at Tennessee.
Keith was.
Yeah.
I know was influenced by.
Uh-huh.
Man, he was just in East Tennessee. Chet Hedge. There was several guys up there that were just had that effect on people. They just loved it so much, you know, because mm-hmm. I think they realized the power of being an educator, and it goes beyond just knowledge, you know, and just stuffing your head with stuff. It was like actually shaping and molding people's lives for the rest of their lives, you know, and that's where the beauty is of teaching. So I just wanted to preface. I have a deep respect for it. It's just when I was teaching, though, I got burned out. So no, to answer your question, I'm not teaching now. No, I'm not. However, I have considered doing some Skype lessons online now that I've kind of got into the remote recording. So I would like to kind of return to that, you know. But
well, with that in mind, in Vegas, are you aware of, or are there any like proper what we'll call like schools of music or places where people do take like lessons in mass, like in other words, where you have a good following of students that play, or for that much, I know University of Nevada at Las Vegas is
That's
there.
Right.
Is there a music school in there?
There sure is, and there's obviously several music stores around the community that they teach lessons at. There's several different actually communities within communities that will have a kind of small neighborhood kind of music programs, you know, kind of like you have your local dance theater thing down the street. Some of these people have music things, but I'm not really aware at this point. I'm sure there is, but I'm not aware of like in Atlanta, we have the Atlanta Institute of Music, or LA, you have that and Boston and stuff, you know, the bigger things. I'm not aware that there's something like that there, but there very well could be.
Gotcha. Now, this, of course, being a drummer's podcast, one of the things that everybody likes to know also is when you're out there, you met any really good drummers?
I have, man. I've met some really good drummers, and I've met not only drummers, but in I think every instrument I've heard, maybe not met so much like on a personal level, but just being the kind of a guy in the corner and just checking things out, I've actually heard some really great musicians. But some of the drummers, man, I mean, that's because to me, as a bass player, rhythm section guy, the drummer is the quarterback, in my opinion. And if you have a weak drummer, the whole thing sucks. I don't care if you have an all-star band. If the drummer is not up to par, the whole thing's destroyed. But if you have a drummer that's amazing and you have a weak band, it makes the whole thing rise. Again, it's just like a quarterback. You can't have a team without somebody who can throw the ball, you know, and lead the team. That's, you know.
Who's the COD drummer? I know he's been there for years.
Eric.
Yeah.
Eric Scribner. And Eric's been there for many years. And Eric is a great dude, man. He's been really encouraging. You know, it's an interesting thing. When you're a new guy in any situation, you come into that environment, regardless if you're getting on a gig or a tour or getting a teaching job or whatever it is. You know, you're meeting people for the first time, and you obviously want to make a good impression, but you just want to be yourself too. You don't want to be phony and stuff, you know. And man, I can just say everybody there has just been so nice and so just kind of taken, you know, just super guys. That's all I can say. And Eric's one of those guys. So the way the COS show works is the band is actually not on stage. It's under the stage, about four floors down in two separate music studios. So Eric, the drummer, and the bass are on one side, and there's a huge glass, and then there's a hallway, and then on the other side of the studio is the MD, the second chair, keyboard, there's accordion, there's cello, there's vocalists, and then they're also running some tracks on some things as well. We're all on in-ears. But so basically on the side that I'm on when I do the show, it's just me and Eric or whoever the drummer is. There's actually thing about it, I don't know if all the shows work like this, but in this case, there's two subs for every chair.
Yeah.
So I've met the other drummers too. There's a guy named George and the other guy I just met named Cameron who just got the job there. And super guys. And I actually got to play with George once, and Cameron was just kind of checking it out. He's just getting worked into the show, integrated into the show.
Right.
But Eric is just a cool dude, and he's a great player. And we've had some really deep conversations because you just sit, just me and him most of the time in that room. And I know he's gotten to hook up with Peter Erskine on several occasions and gone to L.A. He's a California guy, and so he's had several lessons with Peter. And speaks very highly of them.
So now, aside from everything that you're doing out there and all the things that musicians do to make a living, aside from when you recorded your first CDs, the other thing that I thought you had an absolute stroke of brilliance on was you decided, instead of going the route of trying to shop this stuff around and, hey, I'm going to try to get this thing released on a major label, you just kind of took the bull by the horns and you're like, I'm going to teach myself how to actually release stuff, which ultimately ended up with you starting your own label called right. Blue Canoe Records.
That's right.
And I know it's still going. I mean, you started
it's still
it.
Going.
You started like 20 years ago?
I did, but it didn't actually officially start until 2003.
Yeah.
Even though in 96 I was definitely doing stuff on my own. I did a few things after that that I did try to shop. And of course, who gives a crap about a bass record, right?
and you can almost say that about any record now.
Yeah, exactly. You know? But yeah, so it's pretty nuts, man. It's like I had really no intention. So let's just say this. I do have the label Blue Canoe Records, but it started out of my own efforts, my own musical things. And I had no idea at the time. I had no intentions of creating like a real record label. But lo and behold, all these years later, we now have 30 artists on the label and 57 releases, one of which, drum roll please,
nice.
Is Mr. Phil Smith.
Oh, tell me more.
Mr. Phil Smith is actually on the label. Philip Smith's album called Jazz Consortium. Jazz Consortium, Philip Smith, iTunes it now, buy it.
Nice,
it's a great album.
I just realized I've done nearly 100 episodes and never even talked about that.
It's an awesome album, dude. It's jazz. It's playing standards, but arranged by Phil. There's some incredible drum solos. There's some incredible arrangements. Great interplay between the musicians. The song selection's amazing. It's all around the stellar record. So how Blue Canoe morphed was it started from that, but then like friends of mine, like Phil and a few other people, you know, had projects, and it was like I kind of had some sort of small understanding of distribution and, you know, radio and PR and whatnot. And so that's kind of how, in a short version, the label started to unfold, you know.
Well, and also it's really important to realize that the whole aspect of distribution and promotion, when you first started,
oh, Lord,
it was all physical distribution. You know, and the type of promotion, man, you were doing had to do with a lot of postal mailings and advertising and
those bring back nightmares in my life.
How much would you conservatively say that you spent on postage alone?
Probably $50,000.
It's unbelievable.
Maybe not that much. Maybe 25.
Yeah.
Yeah. Overall, maybe not that much. Maybe I'm going way overboard. It feels like it. Like, yeah. Here's an example. Like, so even just a few years ago, so I always had the idea, you know, obviously in 96, we had AOL and internet was just kind of coming up and all this stuff. And so I started seeing the world as a bigger thing, like we all did, you know. And I was like, well, I always am a firm believer too of that quote, you know, think locally, but act globally.
Yeah.
And so I really took that to heart, you know. So I started doing research and finding out radio programs in Switzerland or Japan or Germany and all this stuff. So I started sending out stuff all over the world. And that's where your postage rates obviously go up. What's crazy is up till, I don't really know, maybe a year or two ago, it was like maybe $350, $395 to do. And you have to do a customs form, mm-hmm. and it's just this process, and you got to stand in line. You can't just drop it in the box. And but now they've raised the rates to $13, $13.95, I believe, for anything overseas.
Wow.
It's terrifying. Yeah, so we've obviously had to kind of scale that back a lot, you know. But you still have like the old guard that really wants that physical copy. And then you have obviously the digital thing, which to me is something that always made sense to me, you know, being able to share just like you're doing with the podcast. It just download it now and have it on your desktop, or wait a week and we'll send it to you in the mail. And it might be broken when it shows up too, by the way, because it's all cracked. And
so from that standpoint, when it comes to sales, what are your percentages of sales from online versus physical copy?
Oh, it's almost all digital. There's mm-hmm. very little physical. There's still a little bit. And actually, there was a study that just came out recently that Japan is one of the last countries. I think it's the last country where actually physical still outsells digital. But everywhere else in the world, digital far exceeds physical copies.
What is it about the Japanese, man?
I don't know, dude, but they got it going on with the physical thing. They like having that product, you know?
They are, but if you think about it, they're the outliers in every aspect of life,
well,
man.
Well, that's true. When you think of it on that side of things, you would think they would be leading the digital revolution, you know?
But you would. I know. Okay, here's one. Here's something for you here. We're going to bring it full circle back to death. Did you know that Japan...
Yeah.
Doubles the U.S. in suicide rates.
Really?
Think about that for a minute.
Huh. That's deep.
That's very deep.
But on the flip side of that, I think they only had 3 deaths by guns last year in the whole country of Japan, where we have, what, 30,000 or 20,000 or something?
I think it's about 30,000. Yeah.
So, but that's interesting because I was there 3 years ago. My friend Tom Noguchi, who actually helps with some of the Blue Canoe stuff in Japan.
Yeah.
He took me to this mountain outside of Tokyo, and he's like, ooh, that's the suicide mountain.
Right.
And there's this waterfall, and he says many people jump from that waterfall to their death, and they find them. And it's like every year they find so many bodies at the bottom of this thing when it dries out. And but that's interesting. I could see that, man. I don't know why that would be like that.
They have the suicide forest, too. Do you know about that?
There is a movie about that,
too. Yeah. That is creepy, man.
That's pretty spooky.
Yeah. But here's your wacky thing, man.
Yeah.
Here's your super wacky. I think it's a fact that gets glossed over a lot. You know, we talk about there's 30,000 gun-related deaths in the U.S. every year. Did you know that about 65%, about two-thirds of them, are self-inflicted suicide?
Interesting. So see, I didn't know that. That's just something I've never heard of.
Yeah. So there's a fact that a lot of times gets glossed over.
I see.
And then, but see, that also kind of amplifies the fact that then Japan doubles that, but in non-related gun suicides.
Gotcha.
Like you said, like, you know, wandering out to the forest and never, you know, with the intention of never coming back, jumping off of a waterfall, you know, that sort of thing.
Oh, man.
That's some wacky stuff, man.
That's wacky, dude. You got to be in a sad place to want to do that, you know?
Yeah. So now, again, to morph back into the Blue Canoe thing.
Yeah.
All right. There are, did you say roughly 30 active artists?
That's right. 31, I believe. And we've got like probably 4 or 5 new artists in the pipeline right now to come out. Brand new artists.
Gotcha.
Well, I shouldn't say brand new, but there are a couple are established artists, but new to us.
Yeah. Gotcha. So, how does one effectively make money off that? Because I mean, the obvious thing is, well, you got to sell product, right?
Right.
You have to sell product, but you also get into the thing that there's, like any business, there's overhead.
Yes, there is.
Right. You got everything from the most elemental aspect of, like, you got to pay a host to host a website.
That's right.
Right. There's always, you got to update websites. How much of this are you doing? How much? I know you got Noguchi that you were talking about, yeah, that does some stuff. People have to get paid.
That's right.
How does that whole thing work out for you?
Well, it's tough, man. I'm not going to lie. You know, I feel like my biggest responsibility to you and to all the artists on Blue Canoe is to be accountable. You know what I mean? So it's like, if someone's going to trust their music and their vision and all their stuff that they worked really hard to kind of put it on our label, then there is no higher accountability to me, because the music always comes first. But then you have to be accountability on a financial aspect too, you know? So,
yeah.
So that's there, but yes, we have the normal operating expenses, you know? So it's really tough, and you just have to kind of weigh out, like I said, you know, we've had to really cut back on the shipping costs, because all the contacts that I've done overseas all these years, what used to cost me maybe $200 now is going to cost me $2,000 to mail to those same contacts. It's just not possible. So, because you're talking about one little small part of, that's not the only thing we do. That's one small part of it. So you start adding all that up. So we have to cut costs and have to kind of look at the, you know, where you're spending your money and what you got to do.
Just one other thing from my own kind of file, my Rolodex file, on the physical copies that you do have. Where do you keep those? Okay. Because, you know.
Do you really want to know? No. They're actually sitting in my garage.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense.
I actually
sense.
Have an, and that sounds bad, but I actually have an office space in the garage with a table and a printer. And we kind of dressed up our garage a little bit to be kind of a workspace, because the house that we built in Vegas is a smaller. Here in Atlanta, there's everybody has a McMansion here. You know, all the houses are just designed this way, but they're not like that in Vegas. All the houses are definitely have those, but you're talking $1 million. You know, the house, like a house like we're used to here in Atlanta. So we have a smaller house, square footage and all that. So we just utilize all our space. So they're all stacked in the garage. They're all labeled. I can easy access if I need to get to them and ship them or do whatever I need to do.
Cool. So now we've kind of outlined what's happening in Vegas, right? We got a good overview of kind of what people can expect, what the current climate is. We know about the resident shows. We know about the big, you know, show and review kind of things with like the major artists like Celine Dion and Bette Midler and Cher. We know a little bit about the corporate work, the Cirque shows. We know a little bit about your remote session work, teaching, lack of teaching, that sort of thing. The union versus
not
non-union.
Going to jail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I know, man, that you've done a fair amount of touring, and one of the ones in particular that you and I discussed that we wanted to talk about was your time with Earl Klugh.
That's right.
And kind of an interesting story how you ended up getting that gig.
Well, it's two stories. Yeah, I appreciate you bringing it up. There's two stories to that. So here's something that maybe, I'll tell the story and then you take it for what you want. So it was a Sunday night. I think this was maybe 2009. And my friend, John Rico Scott, drummer, who played with Derek Trucks Band for 16 years and several other things, he's a friend of mine. And he's actually on Blue Canoe, too, with like 3 or 4 albums out. He called me Sunday night about 8 o'clock at night and said, "Yo, dude, what are you doing at 5 in the morning?" I'm like, what, is this a joke? What do you mean? He's like, "No, dude, you, Joseph," and then just, yet another Rico, "Joseph, you must do this."
Yeah.
And it was like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "Dude, Earl Klugh's playing on Live 5 in Atlanta tomorrow morning, and you got to be there at 5 in the morning, and he doesn't have a bass player, and it's to promote his Christmas show."
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, "You must do this." And I was like, "Yes, I'll do it." Terrified, because there's no rehearsals and you're playing live on TV. So I show up at like 5 in the morning, met Earl, met his manager, who's his wife, an extremely amazing person, dude. I can't even tell you how great that their camp is. And so he's like, yeah, I said, Earl, you know, where are we going to play, man? He's like, well, I got this version of Jingle Bells. And he sat on the couch and he just played it. He just played it one time.
No chart.
And I just my antenna's up and just trying to soak that up as quick as I could. So we get on live TV and we play Jingle Bells and he promotes his show. And at the end of it, I was like, Earl, man, this was such an honor. And then Earl was like, no, this was my honor. This was my honor, you know, and just such a great guy. And I was like, wow, that was like, you know, bucket list thing, you know, like incredible moment, you know. And it's like, that was it. And I left. And so this was like before Christmas, obviously. So this was like 2009 before December. So about in March or maybe February, all of a sudden I get a phone call from his manager saying, hey, Joseph, this is blah, blah, blah. And we're calling on behalf of Earl. And Earl wants to book you for a whole year's worth of work on a tour. And one of the tours also includes working with Bob James and blah, blah, blah. Little did I know, probably the biggest thing I've ever done, very thankful, I played on Eric Clapton's Crossroads concert with Earl in 2010. Yanrico was playing drums. Yanrico was doing the tour as well. David Lee was playing keys and Earl. And what's the other amazing story to that is we're actually on the DVD. We have, I think there's one or two songs that we're on. And but what's amazing is when we left that gig, we're playing in the soccer stadium in Chicago. I think there might have been 50, 75,000 people. And I had no idea what to expect because I wasn't really aware of it. You know, and there's cameras flying around and all that. I didn't know we were going to be on the DVD. And thank God I didn't because I would have been way more nervous than I was. But so it was one of the most amazing experiences. I'm very fortunate I had that opportunity. But that was like one of my last gigs with Earl. It's kind of a long story, but Earl, the kind of guy Earl is he's very loyal and he's had the same band for 30 years. Mm-hmm. So what happened was his rhythm section guys basically were involved with a Motown artist that they were producing. And so contractually they had to do this thing. And so there was a conflict. So that's the only reason I got in there. And Earl told me from the very first day, he's like, Luke Joseph, I really like your playing, but I'm just telling you right up front, this is very temporary because I'm very loyal to my guys. I don't care if you're better than him or whatever. It doesn't matter to me because I'm loyal to my guys. And I was like, dude, you got my total respect for that. I'm just glad to be here as much as you or little as you want me. So that says a lot about his character. So he still has the same band. So I knew it was temporary. That said, this Crossroads gig was my last gig. And I'm on the plane with Rico. And I'm like, dude, I can't believe what just happened. You know, we just played in front of John Mayer or right after Vince Gill. It was just all these people behind. There's all these stories. I met Steve Gadd, one of the coolest guys ever. Steve Gadd was so freaking cool. And I'm looking at my calendar and I'm like, Rico, I have no gigs in my calendar. I'm like, dude, we just did the biggest gig of my life. And I'm looking at him like, I have no work. And I'm in the plane, like on a high, but at the same time feeling so depressed. Like, oh my God, what do I do now? It's like, I guess I'm just going to go back to doing, you know, what I've been doing all these years is being a working musician. So it's just, I happened to ride that little train for a minute and I got off the train, you know. And I was very fortunate. Like I said, it's just music is a journey. You just never know where it's going to take you. But the point of the story, the moral of the story is, I'm going down all these rabbit holes. Sorry, I get excited thinking about it. Is if someone calls you for something and the first question is, well, how much does it pay? You might just, of course, you don't want to be taken advantage of. But if I would have said that, or took that kind of stance, I might have just nixed all these cool opportunities that actually did. You know, so you should just take advantage if you're a drummer, musician, whatever you do, just take advantage of any and every opportunity that you have to actually network and meet people and be a yes guy, not a no guy, I guess is my, with some sort of, you know, guardrails in there too. You don't want to be, you know.
Have you done podcasts before? I don't know that we can find a better ending to a show than what you just, with this glorious, happy tale.
Well, somehow the rainbow lives on, dude. I don't know.
My dreams come true.
Hey, man. Vegas. Yeah. Hey, jazz hands. You know, so I don't know, man. It's just, you know, I've had like, we, you know, is in the music career, you're going to have your ups and you're going to have your downs, and you just have to learn to ride that wave. But at the same time, you have to have some sort of vision and some sort of sense of what you want out of your career. And you just have to just learn to just try to, you know, hang tough, you know.
Man, I think that's incredibly sentient, very wonderful words and a sentiment, man, to end on. And, you know, isn't it obvious to say that? Because, I mean, what I'm getting at here is, like, for example, if you and I, if we owned a hardware store, that's the same kind of credo you need to live by.
Absolutely.
You know?
That's right.
And I think it gets overlooked a lot of times.
It does, man. I think so.
For this, because it's you know, we file that under common sense, but we know really that common sense is none too common.
Ah, that's a good quote. That's a great quote, actually.
Man, now we dropped the mic.
Bam.
No, man. No. Dude, it's been an absolute pleasure, brother, having you on the show. It's been a long time coming.
Dude, in the words of Earl Cliff, no, dude, it's my honor. It's my honor. No, really. No, I mean this sincerely. You're one of my dearest friends. I've known you for years, and I respect the crap out of you. Just done awesome things with your life. You got just an incredible musician on so many levels and got an awesome family, and you've definitely been a total inspiration for me, dude. So I'm just so, so cool to see what you're doing, and I'm just so glad to be a part of it.
Well, thank you, man. I'm coming to live with you next week.
Here's your $20.
No, dude, it's absolutely, like I said, an honor to have you on the show, have you back in town. You know, don't get to see you that much anymore. So, no, it's been absolutely great, man. Is there anything else you want to talk about, promote, say anything before we put a button on this thing?
Well, one thing I might want to just quickly mention, you know, like the relationship between bass and drums, like his work and his rhythm section, it's like, don't take that for granted, because the playing together as a bass and drummer, it's really the heartbeat of the music. Like I said, the drummer's the quarterback, but it takes that symbiosis combination mm-hmm. to really create the heartbeat of the music. So I know you and I did this a lot, and it's something I've reflected on, is instead of doing a band rehearsal, just get together with the bass player and just play together and just play, you know, and talk about the placement of the beat, you know, ahead, behind, in the middle, and just kind of how you're playing together as a unit, and then go rehearse with the band, you know, just be strong with rhythm section, you know what I mean? I mean, obviously, rhythm sections includes guitar, piano, et cetera, but just to have that with the bass and drums, I think is a really special bond.
Well, if you do have that, man, you're probably better off than 3/4 of most groups.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good words. Well, man, thank you so much, Phil. It's been awesome, dude. Oh, I've had a blast.
Man, my pleasure. I got to get you out of here, man, here in a few minutes, because you have other commitments that you have to make.
Yeah, I do. So, I have a crazy thing.
Folks, thanks for tuning in. We greatly appreciate your support and your listenership. As always, stay in touch with us. And one of the best places you can do that is our website. We're at drummersweeklygroovecast.com. There on that site is the complete aggregation of everything Drummers Weekly Groovecast. You've got every episode. You got all of our videos. You got all of our mini episodes. You can manage your subscription there. You can also check us out on social media through that website. Of course, we have our Facebook, we have our Twitter, we have our Instagram, and we have our contact form there as well. If you want to get in touch with us, tell us what you like about the show, what you don't like about the show. On behalf of my co-partner, John Chalvin, my buddy across the table here, Joseph Patrick Moore, this is Phil. We'll see you next Monday with a brand new show. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Said bye, man.
Bye. Peace out.